Hello, my friends. This is Dr. Beter. Today is December 22, 1977, and this is my audio letter number 29. 3 days from now will be Christmas Sunday, 1977. On that day, my family and I will join millions of others around the world in celebrating the birth of our Lord Jesus Christ. Like other proud parents, I look forward especially to watching my three small children as they open their gifts. For them, Christmas is a time of pure joy, and that helps to make it so for us grown-ups as well. Even so, this Christmas they will not be receiving the one present I wish they could have most of all, the gift of a future to look forward to, a future of freedom instead of slavery, a future of plenty instead of scarcity, a future of real peace instead of deliberate war. If I had the power to grant my children an abundant future of freedom and peace all by myself, I'd do it. But that is not possible. They cannot look forward to a future like that unless all of our children can do the same. And, my friends, the future which we as a nation are bequeathing to our trusting children is one for which we deserve to be chastised severely by our Lord. Much has been entrusted to us, and we have not measured up to that trust. We in America have always looked back at the tragedy Nazi Germany became and said to ourselves, "How could such a thing have happened? Couldn't the German people see that they were headed toward disaster? Why didn't they do something to stop it?" But apparently we as a nation learned nothing at all from their example or from any of the other lessons in history. Because, my friends, the United States is headed for a disaster that dwarfs what happened to Germany or Japan or Russia or China. It is about us that future generations will say, "How could such a thing have happened? Couldn't the American people see that they were headed toward disaster? Why didn't they do something to stop it?" More and more Americans can sense now that something is definitely wrong. If nothing else, our survival instinct is ringing a muffled alarm inside all of us, warning of imminent danger. But so far, most Americans are still on the sidelines, forfeiting all our rights and failing our responsibilities under the United States Constitution. Instead of analyzing the facts that are already before us, most of us choose the false wisdom called wait and see. Instead of going to the effort to challenge our rulers about matters that are deciding our fate, we deceive ourselves with the notion that at the next election we can discharge our whole duty by casting a vote. Meanwhile, we just sit on the fence while we wait and see. Those who are waiting to see do not have much longer to wait. At the beginning of this year, in Audio Letter 20, I pointed out that we are in the period of undeclared warfare that history will record as pre-war, leading up to the planned nuclear war I. Today, as 1977 is on the wane, the pre-war period is also on the wane. The first stages of war itself are intended to erupt soon, beginning in the Middle East. When I resume recording the audio letter in August of this year, after a silence of 3 months, I warned you that we are now in a new phase as we watch increasingly the fulfillment of man-made plans for disaster and war. Having squandered and wasted the days of grace God gave us to prevent disaster, we as a nation are going to suffer by our own choice. My three topics for today are topic number one, cyclones, earthquakes, and Soviet intimidation of America. Topic number two, the dismantling of the NATO alliance. And topic number 3, America's betrayal into a new Bolshevik revolution. Topic number 1. Last month I told you the locations of the Soviet particle beam weapon installations that are now operational on the Moon. And I warned you that, quote, if the normal Soviet pattern is followed, we can expect a test of a Moon-based particle beam weapon against some Earth target in the very near future. If this is done, it will probably take place under circumstances where its effects can be explained away as having some other cause, unquote. Events are now moving very fast, my friends. When I recorded those words last month on November 21, the first Soviet test shot at the Earth had already taken place, but intelligence about it had not yet reached me. The perfect opportunity for Soviet purposes was provided by a huge cyclone in the Bay of Bengal as it approached the southeast coast of India. Soviet cosmonauts at two of the particle beam installations on the Moon readied their weapons and waited for the angry storm to reach the best possible position for the test. This occurred on the evening of November 19, 1977, as the cyclone was lashing the coastline of the Indian state of Andhra Pradesh. As millions of Indians were struggling against the powerful winds and driving rain of the cyclone, two Soviet particle beam weapons, a quarter million miles away, silently swung around to point in their direction. The weapons were aimed at two nearby locations at sea within the storm. To avoid any chance that the beams might interfere with one another on the way to the target, they were not fired simultaneously, but in quick succession. Traveling at virtually the speed of light, each beam reached the Earth in less than 2 seconds. As I told you in AUDIO LETTER 26, a charged particle beam rips apart the atoms of anything it strikes, causing it to explode. That's why, as I said then, it's an all-weather weapon. It blasts its way through air, cloud, water, armor plate, and anything else it strikes. When each beam aimed at the cyclone reached its target, it produced a brilliant air flash and a tremendous explosion at the water surface. A portion of the water itself was made to explode by the beam, creating a localized artificial tidal wave. The result, as described by victims who lived through it, was broadcast over the BBC on December 13, earlier this month. A relief worker who had just returned from the scene described what she called complete devastation along the coastal area. Everything, including even strongly built houses, had been flattened, and the loss of life was staggering. And what had transformed a bad storm into a total disaster, my friends, was a single tidal wave that suddenly swept ashore in the midst of the storm. I now quote the exact words of the British relief worker as she described what eyewitnesses had told her. Quote, "There were two enormous blinding flashes, and the whole sky lighted up as though on fire. Then this vast tidal wave, about 30 miles in length along the coast and 18 feet high, just bore down upon them." Unquote. My friends, a tidal wave is not a normal part of a cyclone. High waters, yes. Flooding, yes. And normal wind-driven waves, yes, but not tidal waves. And yet, if you will study the news reports from all sources, you will discover that a single devastating tidal wave was reported consistently. Eyewitnesses describe it as something that came suddenly, sweeping away everything in its path, including loved ones. And it caused devastation inland to unheard-of distances, where people have never had reason to fear cyclones before. For example, a ferry boatman in the village of Panumudi is quoted in the New York Times for December 12 as saying, quote, Oh, my life, I have never been frightened so much. We are 20 miles from the sea, and yet the wave came all the way to destroy our boats and our living, unquote. With at least 10,000 dead, over 2,500 villages destroyed, and 2 million homeless, it's no wonder that this cyclone is rated as the worst to hit India in more than a century. From the Soviet viewpoint, the test was a complete success. The ability of their lunar-based charged particle beams to blast an Earth target with devastating force has been confirmed. And by carrying out their test in the midst of a violent cyclone, they succeeded in camouflaging the man-made disaster by combining it with a natural one. Both the lunar and Earth orbital particle beam weapons of the Soviet Union must now be regarded as fully operational and tested. But the lunar particle beam test was scarcely completed before tests began with yet another secret Soviet weapon. Last month, I reminded you of the lightning pace of weapons advancement that was still publicly visible up until the early 1960s. But at the secret level, military technology was advancing even faster. As early as 1962, top military officers were seriously worried about a future threat to America that was then already visible on the technical horizon. This threatened future development consisted of space platforms capable of levitating in stationary positions over our major cities or other strategic locations. These platforms would not be in orbit like normal Earth satellites. Instead, they would actually hover for long periods of time over a single spot. This cannot be done with orbiting satellites, except for those stationed over the Earth's equator about 22,000 miles out in space. So the United States already had the capability long ago to build these hovering platforms if desired, manning them with 40-man crews who would remain aboard for 2 months at a time. Therefore, it was obvious that someday the Soviet Union would also develop this capability, and our military leaders wanted to be in a position to interdict any Soviet platforms that might someday invade the space over our country. But their urgent pleas for authority and funds to develop a defense against the expected threat of floating platforms were rudely turned aside. They didn't fit in with the two-pronged program for world military domination that I explained for you last month. On the surface, America was to be gradually stripped of its known weaponry, while in total secrecy, the Moon program was to provide America's secret rulers with the unadmitted ability to destroy the Soviet Union in a final double cross. Now it's 15 years later. The grand design of our secret rulers lies in ruins, shattered less than 3 months ago by Russia's upset victory in the Battle of the Harvest Moon on September 27. The men and women of America's secret moon colony in Copernicus Crater lie entombed where they died, bombarded by a Soviet neutron particle beam weapon orbiting the Earth. And now the Soviet Union controls the moon, and from it, the Earth. Furthermore, spurred on by the danger of losing the decisive particle beam race, the Kremlin has spent fantastic amounts of money to develop a bewildering array of military weapons of every type. Wherever possible, they have borrowed and exploited whole technologies developed in the West at our cost. They have bought critical hardware to fill gaps in their own technology, paying for it with United States-financed loans guaranteed by American taxpayers. They have contracted for Western multinational corporations to build whole manufacturing facilities in Russia, factories that are unparalleled here at home. And, relieved of the need to develop so many things for themselves, they have been able to concentrate on advanced projects that leapfrog ahead of our own technology in certain areas. And one of these areas is the hovering space platform, which certain of our military leaders were worried about 15 years ago. For many years, the Soviet Union has led the world in the field of high-energy physics and in many areas of advanced mathematics as well. This enabled them to win the race for the particle beam weapon, and has also enabled them to develop a hovering space platform design that operates on more advanced principles than those our military anticipated 15 years ago. The Soviet hovering platform concept is built around a branch of physics most people have never even heard of, called electrogravitics. At the present time, the Soviet Union is using electrogravitic vehicles both on the Moon and in space close to Earth. Theoretically, these vehicles will someday be able to travel directly between Earth and the Moon, and even over interplanetary distances. But the transition from the gravitational field of the Earth to that of the Moon, among other things, is potentially hazardous, so this is not being done yet. Instead, rockets are being used by Soviet cosmonauts to travel between the Earth and the Moon, but the electrogravitic levitation is being used on the Moon itself. The electrogravitic vehicles developed so far by the Soviet Union are still very crude. They can lift themselves vertically up or down using the levitation field they produce, but have to use small rocket motors to move sideways. But crude or not, the Soviet Union now has these hovering space platforms, and we do not. Nor do we have any means of combating them, since our secret masters have refused ever since 1962 to allow any means of defense to be developed. I can now reveal that the Kremlin has begun deploying hovering space platforms over the United States and elsewhere, armed with particle beam weapons. At this moment, 7 Soviet hovering space platforms are already on station over North America and the waters nearby. Platform number 1 is hovering 672 miles above a spot in the Atlantic Ocean, about 170 miles east of Charleston, South Carolina. Number 2 is 821 miles above a spot in the Pacific, 256 miles southwest of Los Angeles, California. Number 3 is floating 784 miles above a spot about 42 miles west of the so-called Four Corners of Utah, Colorado, Arizona, and New Mexico. Number 4 is 821 miles directly above the intersection of the borders of Idaho, Montana, and Canada. Number 5 is hovering 597 miles above a spot that is about 50 miles east northeast of Denver, Colorado. Number 6 is 560 miles above Illinois, over a spot about 80 miles southwest of Chicago and 50 miles east of Peoria. Number 7 is at the same altitude, 560 miles, over a spot about 10 miles northwest of Morgantown, West Virginia, at the border of southwest Pennsylvania. The first 4 platforms are manned. The other 3, launched more recently, are still being checked out by remote control prior to being manned by crews who will be carried there by electrogravitic shuttle. Early this month, on December 2, 1977, the crew of Soviet platform number 1 received the orders they had been waiting for from Moscow. They were to commence defocused beam tests. A defocused beam expands out over a broader and broader area as it flashes through space. And as a result, when the broad beam strikes the atmosphere, most of the energy is spent in the air itself. This is the exact opposite of the situation on November 19, when the lunar particle beams created tight shafts of energy that passed through the Indian cyclone to strike the sea with great power. The crew adjusted their particle beam weapon to defocus the beam to a prescribed amount. Then at approximately 10 a.m., they aimed their weapon at a spot in the sea about 50 miles off the South Carolina coast and fired. The air itself over the ocean east of South Carolina was made to explode with the force of 100 tons of TNT. along the South Carolina coast, thousands of people heard the tremendous rumble from the blast at sea. Dishes rattled and some windows broke. At the Lamont Doherty Geological Laboratory north of New York City, acoustic monitoring instruments jumped off scale. Everyone who heard it wondered what had happened. About 3:45 that afternoon, the crew of Platform 1 were ready for a second test shot. The target area this time was the sea off the New Jersey coast, 650 miles to the north-northeast of Platform 1. The particle beam weapon had been readjusted to compensate for the greater distance involved, and then it was fired. At points along the coast from Cape May, New Jersey to Connecticut, thousands heard the powerful blast as more dishes rattled and more windows broke. Again, acoustic monitors were driven off scale. On December 15, Platform 1 began firing again. At least five blasts were fired into the air over the Atlantic that day. On December 20, just 2 days ago, still more blasts took place. But the major news media have begun to treat the whole matter as if it were a joke. Most Americans do not live on the East Coast, of course, and have not heard these explosions for themselves. But listen to these words that a housewife in Manhattan used to describe one of the explosions to me. It was a bright, sunny day, and my older kids were in school. I was at home when suddenly there was a tremendous, tremendous boom. It sounded like it could have been next door, or it could have been a million miles away. You just couldn't tell. It was a low, thundering, deep, all-encompassing noise. It sounded like a bomb, but I thought it might be an earthquake. I grabbed the kids, my younger kids who were at home, and ran to the wall. I glanced at the clock, and it was just after 1 o'clock. I waited to see what else would happen, but nothing did. I turned on the radio to find out what had happened, but there was nothing on the radio, nothing about what had happened. The kids in school were all scared. The teacher said, "It's Con Edison." But of course, if it had been Con Edison, the whole neighborhood would have blown up. It just sounded as if something had hit the bottom of the earth, unquote. Soviet acts of intimidation are becoming more frequent and more vicious. Only last night, around 7 p.m., another series of so-called mystery explosions were heard off the East Coast. And only today, two grain elevators, one in Louisiana, the other in Mississippi, exploded within hours of one another. The first explosion took place this morning, December 22nd, at the huge Continental Grain Company elevator on the west bank of the Mississippi River, a few miles upstream from downtown New Orleans. Eyewitnesses said, quote, "It went up like an H-bomb," unquote. The ground shook for several seconds as though in an earthquake. A huge mushroom cloud stretched perhaps a mile into the air, and debris from the structure kept falling like feathers into the river. The entire facility, storing $100 million worth of grain, was ruined, and there were scores injured, perhaps 24 killed. The portion of the elevator nearest the river was completely blown off. My friends, when I resumed recording my audio letter last August with issue number 25, I warned that there were 158 Soviet nuclear mines, that is, small H-bombs, buried underwater along the Mississippi River. The destruction of the grain elevator near New Orleans this morning resulted from the detonation of the first of these bombs, which was located in the river near the south end of the loading dock. Other Soviet nuclear mines are still waiting to be exploded within a few miles of that location. One is just across the river from the site of today's explosion in an area known as Carrollton Bend. Another is about a mile in the upstream direction from the ruined grain elevator, under the southeast end of the Huey P. Long Bridge. Looking downstream, another Soviet nuclear mine is lurking in the water beneath the Greater New Orleans Bridge. Further downstream, there is one at the entrance to Chalmette Ship Wharf No. 2. There are two in the Inner Harbor Navigation Canal, one just north of the lock and another about 3/4 of a mile north of that. And not only is the river mined, for example, there is a nuclear mine in Lake Pontchartrain near the south end of the Pontchartrain Causeway. It has now been 4 months since I revealed the situation in the Mississippi River. Since that time, I have never been contacted by a single official having jurisdiction of any kind along the Mississippi River to find out more about the situation. No one has made the slightest effort to take action, and now many have lost their lives and many more are injured. About 2 hours later, the second grain elevator suddenly exploded in Tupelo, Mississippi. Like the first, it was destroyed by a Soviet nuclear mine, but Tupelo is not on a river, and the mine was buried in the ground nearby. Having first sabotaged America's water resources, then important governmental and military sites, the Soviet agents are still crisscrossing our land unhampered and far advanced in sabotaging our food warehousing facilities. Major grain elevators throughout the Midwest, the Great Plains, and other grain-producing areas have been mined already, like the one that exploded today at Tupelo, Mississippi. My friends, how long will we continue to just wait and see? How many will die before the rest of us open our eyes to the truth as it really is? Will it go on this way until the day destitute survivors of nuclear war I are picking their way through the smoking ruins of America with 160 million dead?